Hi, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today we're talking about the possibly contentious rule of cool. When should a GM stick to the written rules, and when is it better to bend or ignore them because the table is fired up about a particular moment? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into today's topic, everyone, I will remind you, as always, at the end of the session, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That's a live video chat that Dan and I host with all our patrons on our Discord server, and you can join in. Just become a patron. Visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, join at any tier level, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. Get that all set up and ready to go before the end of the show, and maybe about 10 minutes after the end of the show, we will be there to chat with you all live.
We love that every week. We just have the best patrons. For example, Backwiz is one of our patrons, checking in that we are currently live on Twitch and YouTube and Restream. So thank you so much for that, Backwiz.
Dan, this happy your eighth season.
Oh, God.
I feel like I want to take a moment to say, happy season eight, Dan.
Happy season eight to you all.
On this long?
I tend to be gritty. I tend to stick with stuff long after other people thought it wouldn't happen. But it's a two plus person job. So happy eighth season to you, Paul, for pointing that out. Wow,
for the D8. We're superheroes.
Yeah, I get it. Okay, I'm glad you said that aloud. Actually, I'm like, oh yeah, I get it. You are correct.
Yeah.
Wow.
We are.
Okay. Wow. Going towards Lords next.
All right. derailed you long enough. Let's talk about the rule of cool.
What? I don't even know what it is, Paul. I don't even know what we're talking about today. What is the rule of cool?
The rule of cool is simply this, for anyone who's not aware. The rule of cool is if it's cool, it succeeds, right? That is simply that. So the idea being behind, if there's just a lot of energy at the table for a specific outcome or a specific direction of the game, that as DM, they either don't bother rolling dice, fudge the dice, change the rules, change the content, throw everything out the window, any variety of this, but just go with what the table is excited about. That's the rule of cool. And there's various, you can see this at varying levels, right? Like at some level, this is just yes and, right? At some level, this is just improv 101, right? Yes and. Cool. The party likes, everyone at the table likes this thing. Roll with it. Yes. The place where it gets really interesting, I think, and really, you know, maybe starts to make us uncomfortable is when, in order to implement the rule of cool, we must break the written rule. Right? So, or go off book, right? That's I think the other side of it. So either I'm just going to outright break the rules and do something that it should be illegal in the game rules that we're doing, or I have a module that says a certain thing. These are outcomes. These are things that are happening, and I go, nope, change that. It's actually this other thing that the players have just suggested at the table. And frankly, we are not going to land on a decide. There's no way we're going to draw a nice clean line in the sand and go, this is when you should do it, and this is when you shouldn't do it. I doubt that it is that black and white. But I wanted to talk about it because of the campaign I'm currently running. So viewers may remember me talking last season about a game that was going to potentially be a West Marches style game. It is not, FYI. We just have a consistent, pretty big group. Honestly, I've got about 8 players. Showing up regularly. We just did our third session of the Quest RPG. But I'm using old school content. We started with the Black Worm of Brandensford, which was written for BX D&D. And I intend to continue that arc of looking for pre-existing content that I can adapt for this group. The interesting thing is, between the makeup of the group and their own inclinations, and possibly a little influence from the Quest RPG, because it is more open-ended. It's much simpler, right? There's a lot of cases where there is no rule, so you got to make it up. It's gone in an unusual direction. Let me start with this fact, Dan. It was our third session yesterday. Yesterday, I played our third session, and we had our first ever combat.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so two whole sessions of zero combats. And in this case, I pushed it. I was just like, nope, you're surprised, they attack. Here we go. Okay. It's a
fight. Good. I like
it. It was okay, not like a thing that players, you know, chose into. And oftentimes the players find other clever ways. And I will say, in our second session, I saw the first ever instance of a party befriending a green slime.
Yeah, yep. You told me that yesterday. And I got a little, I was surprised.
Yeah, it's an unusual direction for the game to go. I'll give you the specific example of that. So our party, first of all, if you've not read The Black Worm of Brandonsford, it goes a little in the direction of maybe a little more Fae influenced, a little more fairy tale-esque. There's a lot of that kind of odd things going on. And there are more, frankly, plot lines in there that can and should be solved non-violent.
Okay.
So already the content is maybe a little in that direction. There is exactly two key dungeons in this place. And I could tell right from the first session that, like, key dungeons are just not going to fly with this group. At least not, not in the way of, like, you know, a series of encounters, especially a series of combat encounters. They're not going to enjoy that. They would absolutely rebel against anything that even slightly smacks of Murder at the Zoo. You know, they might enjoy an underground dungeon crawl where it's more puzzly, right? Where it's more like, oh, we're figuring out the background of this place and we're manipulating the environment. They would probably enjoy that. But they don't want to just go to fight. They're one of them actually very aptly asked yesterday, what is the opposite of murder hobos? Because that's basically what they are. The opposite of murder hobos. They're, you know, I don't know, pacifist punks. I don't know.
Horny monsters? is that what the kids are playing these days? Thirsty monsters?
Yeah, it doesn't, no, there's been one romance in the game, but it's not heavy.
Okay.
More so, they are just very, their characters tend in a direction that is almost more explorer/scientist. They're very curious about the world around them,
right.
And they they're great communicators. They're big believers in communication and finding ways to cleverly solve problems without weapons. It took them, I think, until the second session to realize that only one of them had actual weapons. Like actual weapons. They're trying to find this dragon, which is allegedly impervious to all forms of attack, and they discover that there's this magic sap you can coat your weapons in, and they locate the magic sap, and not until they locate it, they go, well, who's got a weapon? Who's got, like, I don't know, a pointy thing to stick into this sap? And there was literally only one of the eight.
Can I just address our viewers just for a second, Paul?
Yeah. Yeah, go for it.
Can you believe what I'm hearing? What is this? What is happening? Jeez.
Thank you.
Okay, look. Granted, at least two of them have like magical damaging spells and shoot like magic bolts out of their hands.
Right, yeah, okay, all right.
Right. And the way Quest is written, if you have a weapon of any sort, a dagger, a sword, a club, anything, it does 2 points of damage. If you don't have any such thing and you're just punching and kicking, it does 1 point of damage. That's the entire difference. So I think the game also kind of is like, yeah, that's fine. You could just run around and punch stuff.
It's true.
You know, it works.
So, if you're going to do this quest, this is not entirely misaligned from the quest rules. And I will point out to viewers, having played two quest campaigns myself, that the mechanics are so light that and among the things that was surprising to me when I started playing Quest was every single skill check is a D20, where if I recall correctly, 13 or more is success. That's it. There's no bonuses. There's no ability modifiers. it's always 13 or higher no matter what. So it's not like you're actually avoiding a particular bunch of mechanics that's built into the game when you play like that.
Yeah. You know, I guess, in again, the rules are very light. They're very open-ended to interpretation. Yeah. I certainly have been adjudicating now and then arbitrary bonuses based on situational, like, okay. Because of blah, 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 I'll give you a plus one or I'll, you know.
Okay. I never saw that. In like 2 years of playing, I never saw Max do that with us. That's an interesting novelty.
Yeah, actually, frankly, it only dawned on me after yesterday's session to start texting Max and go like, how did you do this? Because you're the only other person I know who's run this system. But here, I think I'm just going to put William's comments up on screen here because he has got my players. And he says, sounds like a group more suited to some sort of Star Trek RPG. Go to planet, reason with monster. Yep, that is for sure how they are playing. They're absolutely playing it like fantasy Star Trek. That is 100% what they're doing.
All right. As an aside, I have to blurt out. I apologize. I blurt out that last night. So I went to an evening of improv and performed here in New York a couple times. And among what I saw was Red Shirts, which is an all women Star Trek improv musical theater group. And apparently they go to. So I got to see them and speak with a couple of them. They're great. I guess they go to conventions. So if you get to see Red Shirts, check that out. So I'm like, and they said, are you a big fan of Star Trek? And I'm like, I could recognize the references. So I was semi-confronted by more militant Star Trek fans last night than I'm accustomed to, which was great. I will say that the thing that popped into my head is I'm wondering if your players would interact well with Call of Cthulhu, actually.
Interesting. Maybe. Yeah. Especially, I think they would if you played it in that vein of the evil can be overcome, right? It's not Call of Cthulhu, we're all collapsing under the horrors, but more of an adventuresome, like, we are going to fight back. Going to figure out how to fix the problems. They might enjoy that. Yeah.
I could also imagine just a mystery to determine like what, why, or where, or who did the horrible thing. Like we're not ourselves going to get destroyed at the end, but we're trying to figure out can we determine what the secret mystery is or something.
I mean, for what it's worth, I don't think that they're super pushing hard against the rules of Quest. I think Quest is actually a reasonably good fit as well, to be honest.
Yeah, I agree.
Where I struggle sometimes is the content, right? Especially because I'm looking at old school modules and like, how do I adapt this? How do I adapt that? And they're very combat heavy, right? Like they vary, I think, from combat heavy to very combat heavy. In my opinion. So that was really interesting, right? So in this case, let me give you this specific example. They're walking into this dungeon. They're getting close to a room that I know has a pool in the center of the room with some gold coins at the bottom of the pool. And floating on top of the pool is a weird-looking green algae. Surprise, surprise, it's green slime. Classic setup, right? Absolute classic, you know, D&D setup here. On the stairs down towards this room, there is specific mention of a goblin who had been exploring in the area who's died. So they find a corpse of a goblin. And one of the things listed on his inventory is a couple of gold coins. And so I decide, improv, in the moment, my improv brain kicks in and I go, oh, there's little bits, there's little flecks of green slime clinging to some of those gold coins, right? He's been in that room. He's fished out a couple of those gold coins. Maybe he even hurt himself a little bit. There's little flecks of green slime. So one of the players picks up the gold coin and rolls a really good roll to like examine it or something like that. I can't even remember. So I describe like, oh, you see just a tiny flicker of movement, like the algae clinging to this, to the coin kind of slides around to the other side away from your light, right? Something like that. Right. Right. Nice and creepy. I'm trying to build up creepiness and suspense and maybe foreshadow a little bit. This player is immediately fascinated by that, right? They're playing kind of this ecologist sort of character. Like, I'm going to write notes about this. This is fascinating, right? Oh my gosh, what is this thing? Right? They enter the room with the pool, and they look at it, and rather than have, again, this is like such a classic old school D&D trap. Haha, I'm going to get the players. They're going to reach in for that gold coin and they're going to, you know, get covered in green slime. No, they decide what they really need to do is return the 3 gold coins to the pool so that the little creature that's living on the gold coin can rejoin its family.
No! What? No! What's happening?
They are not at all Indiana Jones here. They are not here to steal and plunder. They are here to preserve and learn, right? So they're like, they're not interested in stealing lots of treasure. That just doesn't register with them, right? They're here to preserve the environment, to help anyone who has problems, right? They want to problem solve. And they want to protect the, you know, ancient sites.
Okay, I know this is where this anecdote is to go. Okay, I find myself unable to prevent putting my thesis in here at this point. Here's Dan's response. Absolutely not. No way. Okay, so responding specifically to the rule of cool, that whatever's cool and what everybody at the table is in favor of is definitely going to happen. No role necessary. No way. Absolutely not. What I'm hearing described is not remotely what D&D is set up to do. And I love these players. And despite all that, I'm 100% totally on their side. I love what they're doing. I love what there's happening. And I want to get in there. And I want to. And if I was playing, I want to fucking help them do exactly this stuff. I love everything they're trying to do. I'm going to be grappling with how to resolve that at this point.
Yeah.
So what happened when they're returning treasure? What the hell?
Yeah. If I recall correctly, I might be hazy on the details already because this was session 2, but I'm pretty sure what happened is I asked for a die roll. Again, one of the nice things about Quest is super simple. The die roll is the die roll, yep. Right? It just gives you a scaler of how successful or how much failure or whatever. And actually, you know, and I know this is the for anyone who's not played Quest, my favorite thing about Quest and the most difficult thing and my favorite thing, it's super weird. It's both challenging and sometimes I hate it and it's horrible, and sometimes I absolutely adore it and love it, is that there's a range of numbers, right? 1 is absolute critical failure, 20 is critical success. There's a range that is just straight success. And then there's a range that is like a qualified success. I can't remember exactly what they call it, but it is a tough choice. Yeah, something like that. Where they basically says the outcome is 1, whatever the player was trying to do ultimately does succeed. But 2, something bad also happens. And you as GM must give them a choice of 2 potential bad things. And they get to pick which one. Right? Yeah. So it puts me on the spot all the time to invent really weird stuff, which I both, you know, gives me anxiety. And I feel like I'm getting repetitive. I'm like, I already used that one. I got to do something else that's clever. Right? So I'm just like constantly on this pressure to come up with like cool, interesting stuff. But also like, hey, I'm constantly under pressure to come up with cool, interesting stuff. It's like really feeding my improv brain. And I love it. I love it. It's like, yeah. Cool, weird stuff. Anyway, she aces the roll. Absolutely aces. Hell yeah. 100% succeeds. Like, okay. Well, you put the coin, you slide the coin into the water and the little blip of green like detaches and floats to the surface and rejoins the mass and it kind of bubbles and gurgles and floats. And they go, great. Job well done, everyone.
And just remind me. So, what is the roll for in this case? What are we checking to succeed?
I was imagining whether or not she disturbs the green slime, the dangerous green slime on the surface of the pool as she's trying to put the coin back.
Okay.
Right? Like how carefully do you put it back versus how much do you like screw with it?
Got it.
Everybody just correct. Like, I don't know if they recognize that it was a green slime. I don't know if there's enough D&D experience at the table for them to even know what was going on, other than they're like, there's a creature here, and we want to. You know, they were also, to be fair, they're exploring. Okay, a little bit of spoiler here for anyone who's not read the Black Worm of Brandonsford. The main plot arc is that there is a dragon in the woods who is terrorizing everything, and please deal with this dragon. There is a legend. The whole reason the town is called Brandonsford is because there's a legend of Sir Brandon, who hundreds of years ago slew a dragon, and he was a hero, and his comrades were heroes, and they built the town and they named the town after him. He has a burial mound out in the woods. There's a barrow mound where Sir Brandon himself is buried with his chanted sword. And again, remember, one of the legends of the dragon is like its scales can't be pierced by normal weaponry. So, hey, here's an actual lead for a real magic weapon. So the party is 100% in this dungeon because they're like, we need to find the sword of Saint Brandon because it will help us slay the dragon. But we need to be super respectful. Don't disturb the place. Take only the. We're just here for the sword. Don't screw with anything. This is a wow. Sacred place, right? This is a sacred holy place. Do not screw with it.
Wow.
Generally, they're at.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
So they come in with a lot of reverie and a lot of care, and they're just trying to very much not, disturb the place, but also, and of course, so they have a character, again, I'm going to dig into quest a little bit here. There are 8 roles in quest. The roles are very similar to D&D classes, right? You've got the fighter, you've got the wizard, you've got the, you don't have a cleric. No cleric, Dan. Mm-hmm. They have a doctor.
Yeah.
They have a doctor. And the doctor class, you could absolutely infer that the abilities are granted by some heavenly being if you wanted to, or magical in nature, or you could go science-y with them. Either, whatever you want to do. We have 2 characters in my group. 2 players have decided to go doctor. One of them has decided that he is like, basically like a boxing coach, like a grizzled old boxing coach. He is there to help the hero kill him. Right, his type of doctoring is like I'll slit your eye, put the swelling on your eye, so you can.
He's the cut man. Out there he's the party cut man.
Exactly.
Okay, exactly. Right. I don't mind that. That's good.
The other doctor is skewing necromancy. The other doctor is like, I'm obsessed with the dead. I want to talk to the other side. I want to commune with the spirits, etc. And there's a bunch of abilities in the doctor for exactly that. So here we are in an underground place. With ghosts and undead and whatnot, and we've got a doctor character who specializes in that, but she doesn't not using it to like control them or kill them. She wants to talk to them.
Got it.
Talk to them. And like that just opens up a whole chunk of role play that is actually really like fun and weird, but it definitely has me going in the direction of like, well, I can tell, and again, in our old school, in the kind of old school modules that I love, Dan, there's a lot of blank space, right? If you read the Black Worm of Brandensford, I can often like kind of read between the lines and know where they were going with something, but it's not explicit, right? Okay, sure. Here's this ghost. He's got this horrible axe. There's a goblin who is clearly slain by this ghost with the axe somewhere else. Clearly, the ghost's motivation is just mad mayhem, right? But also, there's some hints about, like, this is the ghost of one of the companions of Sir Brandon, and, they're protecting their home and whatever. So, like, you could really interpret this ghost's motivations in a whole bunch of different ways. Reading between the lines, I'm like, well, this is written as an encounter for the players to fight. Pretty, like, most of the words are based around, like, the statistics for fighting. But that's not what my players want to do. They want to talk to this ghost. They want to assure this ghost that everything's going to be cool. They're going to be respectful, and they're just here to help out his homeland.
Wow.
And this is a case where, for me, like, I don't know, rule of cool kicks in, and I'm like, yeah, okay, that all makes sense. I think the ghost is going to be cool with you guys. I think he's not going to attack you. He'll attack that stinking goblin who's here to steal his treasure, but you're being very respectful, and you're, like, open communication, and you're very clear about what your goals are with him, and you're, like, trying to save his homeland. I can't figure out how you could talk to this ghost in a better way. I think he's going to be helpful. So,
I mean, I would go in the direction of say he might be helpful. I mean, it's not a completely insane food to eat. I like the creativity, and my instinct in those situations is that he might be helpful. Maybe it's not completely ludicrous.
And there is a part of my head space, right? So one thing is when we get into like we're going to talk to the monster NPC. If I'm in a headspace of yes, this thing can talk, then usually I like to veer away from dice and just root myself in what is the motivations of this creature.
Yeah.
Now my turn to roleplay, right? I must now embody and roleplay this thing.
This is also a pretty strong argument, actually. I said that blithely, I also tend to not have a ton of dice in my role playing interactions. I think that actually might be it's not insane, it's not crazy. Yeah. I see where you're coming from.
Another thing that's in the back of my head is as I'm watching the players do all these things and they're really super enjoying these various interactions.
Yeah.
Looking at the layout of this 20 room dungeon and thinking like they might find some of this tedious. This might become not fun for them, right? And in fact,
you're talking specifically if you were running all fights, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, or just that. Yeah. Or that, like, I can't have every... It would feel weird to me if they're wandering through this tomb, making friends with every single ghost along the way, and then what? They end up in the final room with a freaking entourage of ghosts hanging out with them, and it just starts to get weird, right? Like, I feel like, really? Probably one of the ghosts should get pissed at some point, or be unreasonable in some way, or something. I don't know. It's definitely... I found myself going in the direction of, and I'll tell you how this landed, right? So, and also just time, right? This is also, there's the time management element in my
head. Which is maybe more important than anything else.
Yeah. So they're it's going to take them forever to roam through this 20 room dungeon, which has a lot of challenges that frankly, you know, they're going to try and solve in the same ways. And I don't know how much fun it's going to be to continually beat this over the head and eventually force them down a violent resolution that they're not super excited about. Or I could just have this ghost I currently talk to go point and say, there's the secret door to the end room. The thing you're looking for is in there. Go get it.
Really?
Which is basically exactly what I did.
Yep. Really? Okay.
Because it existed. It 100% existed in the dungeon. Yes, there is in fact a secret door that leads to a passage that goes straight to the end room. It's right there. They've told this ghost, they've made friends with this ghost, and they've told him, this is what we're here for. We're not going to disturb anything. We're not going to take any of your treasures. We just want the sword. There it is. Go get it. And they 100% went through it and did all like, it was still like a little weird challenge to open a specific door that required them to have some knowledge of the world, which they did. And they successfully puzzled their way through it, got the sword, went out, were like exited the dungeon. They're like, that was great, right? The whole table is just like, that was excellent. What a great, fun adventure that was. And I'm like, yep, skipped like 90% of it, but yeah, cool. Okay.
Do you think, I'm so glad that this is probably the most foreign gaming experience that I've received possibly in all my days. So there's a lot to both the system mechanics, the players, the situation and how you resolved it that is wildly, wildly off the table of anything that I've engaged with. Do you think, I'm glad everybody had a good time. I'm glad that you, you know, were present to see what the players were interested, where they were going, and to say yes to that. Do you think going forward that using, and I think the quest system sounds like a great matchup for the way that things are happening, and also with the large number of players too.
I can't tell if using quest is the cause or the effect. There's a little bit of that of like. Are we going down this road because quest is pushing us this direction, or is quest enabling us to go down a road that we wanted to go down anyway? And quest was just a happy accident of the right choice to enable us to play in this way.
My guess is probably the latter, is that you've got a nice synchronicity there between system and desires. So my question is, going forward, do you think that using old school adventures that were written for BX is the way to go in the future?
Yeah. That is the big question. But if not, what then, right? Because I've talked to him before on the channel about how much my DMing style is this kind of patchwork quilting style, right? I love taking different bits of content from here, there, anywhere, and integrating them into a greater whole, of a story that's happening in the world. And now I find myself digging through all of these old modules and looking for more stuff. That is, I'm looking for dungeons that are more about exploration and kind of puzzle dungeons, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. Stuff where like figuring out the dungeon is more important than overcoming the inhabitants.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm very interested. And I've gotten there a couple. There's a few, but they are okay. Few and far between. There's certainly, okay. Certainly plenty of modules where I'm like, nope, that one's never going to work.
I have, okay, so, and I think that, you know, the way that D&D is set up and the expectations and what it's trying to do, and it's, you know, at its root, it came out of war game mechanics, and it, you know, traditional D&D is war game mechanics. Usually those kinds of, you know, for D&D, those puzzle dungeons usually had like a big asterisk, like, this isn't your normal dungeon. Just be aware that if your players are bust down the door and kill the monster, they may not be happy here. So amusingly, and I don't think you should do this for the next adventure, maybe two or three down the road. It would be really interesting to hear this group use Quest to go through Tomb of Horrors.
Yes. In fact, I love right? it. I love it.
Yes. Yes. Right?
Yes.
Yes. Right?
But I think you're right. Right. That content actually is, because how many fights are there in Tomb of Horrors? One, two, barely any. One, yeah, okay. Yeah. So I think you're absolutely right. I think that would be a great piece of content to try and get into here. Yeah.
Granted that usually the penalty of a lot of Tomb of Horrors is instant death. It's either instant death or it's, you know, transported naked someplace or gender switch. I don't know. You know, some people are going to like two out of three of those. So, but the instant death part, I don't know how your group's going to react to that or what you want to do to massage that.
That might be a bit harsh. That might be a bit harsh. But right. Also, frankly, I will say that like the expectation of Tomb of Horrors is that your characters are of a level where coming back from the dead is not an unreasonable outcome.
Well, that's an interesting observation, actually. Yeah, that's an interesting observation.
So, so I might want to play with that, frankly. And that's something, actually, that there's an adventure that's been in the back of my head for a long time around, can't remember, I think Dungeon Crawl Classics did this, a dungeon that where basically the entire adventure is, we need to go into the underworld and rescue the soul of our dead friend so that they can come back to life.
Yeah, great.
I think if we have a player death in this game, or when we have a player death in this game, mm-hmm, I think mm-hmm. that will be a very fun adventure for them, and they would absolutely dig right into that.
Interesting.
So that's in the back of my head. You know. Puzzle dungeons. I don't want to go too deep down that road, Ben, because spoiler alert, we might have a guest coming up very soon to talk specifically about old school puzzle dungeons.
Okay, so, well, we might need some input. We might need some input on that point.
That might help this conversation quite a bit. but you are right, right? I'm digging through my back catalog of stuff, and I will say that I am erring more towards, frankly, more OSR stuff and less original stuff.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Right, like a lot of the content written for Lamentations of the Flame Princess seems like it'd be a good fit.
Okay, yep.
You know, that kind of stuff where there's just like really weird, wacky things to figure out in the dungeon that don't necessarily involve kill a bunch of goblins.
Okay, yep, I see that. That seems like a good choice.
Now, again, not 100% combat free. And I did. So basically, in the last session, they were walking along the riverbank up towards where they thought the dragon might be. And I'm 100% doing, by the way, absolutely wandering monster rolls all the time. They have a delightful overland map of the area. And they know whenever they tell me, okay, we're going from here to here, I quickly calculate and say, okay, that is X number of rolls on what I call the travel die. Please roll the travel.
I love it.
Roll it a bunch of times, and we see if stuff happens. And in this case, they got attacked by Sturges about halfway through.
Okay. Yep. Good.
And amusingly, in the wandering monster chart of the Black Worm of Brandonsford, it is probably the most straightforward combat encounter. All of the other encounters on wandering monster, like probably they could twist into some like, well, we're going to talk to this person.
Yep.
Creature. But in this case, I was like, nope, you get attacked, and they dug in, and they enjoyed it. They had a nice
Okay, good.
They're not complete nonviolent, right? They're not completely nonviolent, but they are interested in taking this more careful approach and this more
fascinating,
you know, pacifist approach. It's just really interesting, really unusual. Where's Dan? We've spent spent a lot of time talking about the specific background of this particular campaign I'm running. Unless, I would like to pull it back a little bit more to the rule of cool, and maybe Quest is giving me an unfair advantage on rule of cool because like Quest is basically telling me to do it. In D&D, where do you want? Where's your line of like? Well, your line's going to be much different than mine. But like, what kind of things are we interested in invalidating or pushing with the rule of cool versus where are you like, nope, D&D says X, that's what happens.
Well, what a fascinating and deep question. So, you know, I was out in improv night last night and I, you know, did a little bit of performing and it was fantastic and I love it and it was empowering and got great reactions from what we did. And are very much thinking about yes and in that situation, supporting everyone around us as equal players. And I think that, what I get out of gaming in general, not even role-playing games, what I get out of gaming in general is something very different. There's a lot of overlap with improv and role-playing games. With gaming, I get something very different. And partly it's learning lessons about exploring the mechanics and exploring the world and lessons about dealing with failure and with things where we attempted to run an experiment or something and we discovered that it was unlikely or something unexpected that we didn't want to have happen. And to me, and I've said this a couple times before, like when I used to play poker with friends, it came to the point where the number one reason why I was playing poker was I was interested in how my friends dealt with a bad beat, which is to say they made a good move. They made a good bet. It should have worked. And some highly improbable result occurred where they lost instead and they frankly shouldn't have. And I was very interested in what was the moral response to a completely legitimately unfair failure was the most interesting thing in that game. And so for me, you know, with playing, you know, D&D, and you can talk about like one thing that's on my mind this morning is, and you know, we have friends, Paul, you and I occasionally have debates about, are we telling a story with D&D? And some of us say yes, and some of us say no. And I kind of lean on the no side. I think we can kind of discuss like are we honoring feelings or are we honoring mechanics? And somewhere in that continuum, I think, is are we gaming for escapism or are we gaming for as a model of something? And I do think that I embrace D&D as fundamentally being a war game at its root and training us and learning lessons for how to solve problems and work as a team and possibly deal with failure. And, you know, I don't mind, and it's really interesting with Quest where they've just removed all the mechanics of armor, weapons, what works well against something else. And in contrast, I like D&D having those relations between what piece of equipment, what armor, what weapon works in this situation and not that, to learn about that and learn about finding, you know, learning about our resources, learning how to apply them to problems where we may not succeed. So my thing in D&D is it's not yes and, it's yes, you can try that. The answer to me is always yes, you can try that. And let's maybe I'll tell you, or maybe we'll even negotiate how likely it seems for this particular action to work in this particular world. And then we'll see whether you succeed or fail. So I don't think my heart is ever like, and frankly, the fact that if all the players are in favor of something happening, That's actually grist for my mill to possibly discover that it didn't happen. It's like that actually makes me focus a lot more of adjudicating exactly how, like, now I kind of want it to fail. As the old school DM, I kind of want it to fail to see what your response is to the thing that you know, and I don't think I'm going to pull the strings, but I'm going to carefully adjudicate how likely that was. So before I run out of time, but I have to give you, I have to, and you may have heard this before, but I have to recall this morning the time that I was running one of Janelle Jacquet's old school dungeons. And I was trying to do it. I had the battle map out. I was trying to do it as gritty as I possibly could. And there's a room with, I think, two manticores. And, you know, thinking about the relations in space, they're in a corridor. And the manticore is so big, it can barely fit down the corridor. It's actually filling the entire corridor. And our party is confronting it, trying to get through this thing where it's entirely jammed up with its multiple attacks and its spikes and so forth. And so our wonderful friend Lauren, who almost always plays a hobbit rogue, says, "Can I go and scoop myself under the belly of the manticore into the room behind it, and then I can start getting backstab attacks from the other side?" And I'm thinking in my head, and I'm like, there's this giant, you know, monster. It's got wings, it's got spiky tails, it's got multiple attacks, it's got claws. And in my head, I frankly don't see any way that there's space. I just don't see in my head there's any way there's space for someone to go running under the manticore. And I, you know, frankly, I tell Lauren no. I say no. That's clearly no way that can possibly happen. But the way that I say it is I say, "You're going to need a natural 20. I don't see any way that's going to work. So just to be clear, it's filling the whole space. It's wildly improbable. And so you can try it, but you're going to need a natural 20, which from my perspective was how I say no. And, you know, I'm thinking, you know, I don't think it's going to work, but I could be wrong. So where's the confidence interval for how sure I am about my own opinion? And I'm like, I think I'm 95%. My way. Well, Lauren takes that response and she's, "I'm absolutely doing that." I said, "Well, then I'm absolutely doing it." And I'm like, have I miscommunicated? Did I have a stroke? I don't know. Did you not understand? I just told you it's practically impossible. I'm like, "Oh, okay." And then someone says, "Can we get the dexterity bonus?" I'm like, "Yeah, fine. You can get the dex. It's 2 points. You can get the dexterity bonus. You're going to need an 18 or 18, 19, 20. And Lauren takes the die, and you know what's happening, viewers. She absolutely rolls a natural 20. Absolutely. Yep. And I was great. It scoots under the manticore. And now that, you know, now that the reality has, you know, turned into something I didn't expect, I'm like, yes. And you get to it, and you stick up your sword and you slice the manticore. I'm going to give you a back attack under the manticore as you slide through, and you do triple damage, and now you're behind it. So I feel like I want to say, and the players are all happy, and I'm all pissed off, which is pretty much what always happens. So I tend to want to say, yeah, you can try it. And you know, maybe this crazy thing will work, but I tend not to give out. Like, I do want, like, I want to interact with the world, and I want to interact with the rules, the mechanics. And one of the great things in my Star Frontiers campaign the last couple of years was exploring the world, not giving the characters the rules. And in order to learn the rules, they had to engage with the world first, and then they would come up and know what the mechanics are. And I think that for me, learning those lessons about how to figure out what our resources are and what works against these challenges is a really important. And then recovering from the failures is an important track, and it's maybe among the most important things that I've gotten out of role playing in D&D is how to learn to deal with these horrible challenges. They're not all going to go in our direction. I want to learn in the safest space possible how to deal with failure, and our gaming table should be that space, that safe exploratory space where we get to learn how to manage our own emotions to recover from failure. That's among the most important things. And I know that's not what everybody comes to the gaming table for. Some people want that escapism. It's like, my life is hard, days are dark. I want to avoid all of that and just have and just experience successes from start to finish. But you know, for me, I get a different thing out of gaming. Is this is the place where we can safely take risks. And so that's my slightly different take on what I personally get out of traditional D&D, and the way that I'll probably keep playing it.
Something that jumps out to me as you're talking here is one of the key differences between D&D and Quest here is the expectation of stake setting. And as I say that, I'm not even sure if this is really even necessarily codified. Not in D&D, it's not like spelled out exactly that this exists, but I think we can imply it pretty heavily from a lot of the different writing that, yes, when you're in a situation where the player's doing something unusual, yeah, something that is not covered necessarily in the rules, that seems out of bounds or whatever, that you feel then inclined to say, well, I'm at least going to set the stakes. They may be really difficult. You need a natural 20, but I'm going to set those stakes. So it's maybe not the rule of cool, but it's certainly the rule of possible. Right?
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about Quest is innately Quest does not have this, right? Quest is a safe flat table.
Yes.
Right, it's just a flat table of D20 results with no modifiers of any kind. And so no matter what the player tries, if I ask them to roll the die, good chance it's going to succeed actually on this table. Like more than 50% chance that actually what they want to happen is going to happen.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm surprised to hear that you say that when Max was running this, that he wouldn't apply modifier. I'll give a very specific example. In the Black Worm of Brandonsford, absolutely, the monster can only be hit with magic weapons for sure. Magic scales totally repel any non-magical attack, except for a few key locations. The eye is vulnerable. Inside the mouth is vulnerable.
Oh,
calls that out, and it's referred to. There's murals somewhere of St. Brandon stabbing the monster straight in the mouth, right? And then it says exactly probably what you would expect in the text description of, yeah, a player can make an attack against the eye at -6, and if they successfully hit, they'll blind the creature, right? My players figured this out. My players absolutely figured this out. And they were like, I want to stab it in the eye. And I was like, I'm not just going to ask them to roll the die. I felt very much correct in saying, great, I'm shifting. Okay. Like, you're going to have a big fat minus on your die roll.
Because
is difficult. What you're trying to do is very difficult. But the reward, but possible. But definitely possible. By the way, players totally stabbed the creature in the eye with the sword of St.
Of course they did.
Right?
Of course they do. You know, I mean, if I had picked up Quest and not seen anybody run it, I mean, that would certainly be my instinct as well. And I mean, to my understanding, I think Max was running just by the letter of the law, the black letter text. You know, and it was very surprising to me that the rule was just always this fixed number. But yeah, we played two completely through campaigns, and to my knowledge, we never modified the die roll at all for anything.
It's nice and freeing because I don't feel like I need to have constant, this ability, this skill, this magic item, this spell, whatever gives you these pluses or these minuses. Most of the time, it's a flat roll. But I can't imagine not having the leverage to do it when I feel like, oh, well, this situation warrants it. Right, this situation is unusual and outside the realm. And again, the book doesn't explicitly talk about it, but I also think it doesn't explicitly say you shouldn't do it. And then similarly, like what you're talking about with rolling a d20 and needing a 20 to slide underneath a manticore, I challenge you to find that rule in a player's handbook. Right, that's that was made up on the fly.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, one thing I would say is, I mean, certainly, you know, again, with D&D, with a larger corpus of mechanics that are gauged to level and danger and health and armor and weapons and stuff like that, obviously there's stuff that pops up. We all know this. When stuff pops up that's not covered in the rules, like I would want the response, I would want the adjudication to be, kind of balanced with the rest of the mechanics. So my concern with a rule of cool is if you come up with something and it's just obviously on the face of it more advantageous than any weapon or spell or any other action, and then from then on for the rest of time, every single combat encounter always has to be I pull out the magic card of, you know, whatever. Yep. So I feel that my adjudication of the chances in that case were in the zone where I, you know, that was my best effort guess at how likely that was to really work for what it's worth.
Yeah. And I think that what you're talking about is very much in the realm of like what we would see, say, written in Matt Finch's Old School Primer, right? Like he will talk about how the old school mentality is to find ways around problems mm-hmm. to avoid dice rolls. Yes, there are standard dice rolls for these such and such things, and the odds are against you. So manipulate the environment and find ways that will allow the DM to say, yeah, that what you're saying is logical and sensible, and there's no reason to roll dice because it just works. And isn't borderline rule of cool, isn't it? Isn't that borderline rule of cool?
Entirely convinced by that. There's a couple of things that Matt says that I'm not 100% totally on board with, actually.
Gotcha.
Working the thing in, working the unusual context in as a modifier or a thing, maybe.
I feel like you're probably going to disagree with the statement, Dan, but I kind of feel like you and I agree and we are just negotiating price here. This is.
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, one of the things I wanted to say was the price is up to the dice is the, you know, for me, I'm taking an opportunity to try to gauge my assessment of the world and probabilities and statistics and stuff like that. And, you know, that's all very close to my heart and like how I learned D&D and how I went through my education, why I have a career and why I can pay rent, frankly. So, you know, me dishonoring that path would be personally hard for me. But yeah, I mean, the truth is, you know, and occasionally I fantasize about an improv show. Okay, why is all this improv yes anding getting mixed in with my D&D gaming? Well, how about I push it in the other direction and I take some of my I think about like an improv show where there is like a, you know, some kind of probability machine that once in a while comes out with a no, comes out with whatever we just said, no, that doesn't happen. And you have to pivot and respond to the unexpected no. Because that, to me, that interface is where the ephemeral, really interesting thing is about D&D is like responding to the no's. Look, I have had some experiences, just to say it vaguely, recently, whereby there was a couple of things where people truly held in their heart so dearly that something was going to work, and it didn't. And frankly, they came away bitterly disappointed at what they, something good they really, really thought they could make happen, and it just wasn't going to work. And they had to reassess their understanding. So I want to practice that at the gaming table and not when something more critical is happening in the real world. So that's D&D is learning how to come together, work as a team, pool our resources, and support ourselves in the failures. Those are the most interesting times. So I don't want to delete those from my table.
Yep. And I think that's that's where rule of cool gets too much for me when you're simply letting the players do whatever the hell they want without any kind of stakes, without any kind of risk, without any, you know, no cost of resources, no chance of luck. You're just going like, yep, that sounds fun. That happens. Right. I don't know. I think like you, I want to say that things are always possible and I do want to set stakes. And I think that the place where it really gets the most unusual for me and the hardest for me to figure out is when I'm in those negotiation or social interaction You know, the player is now talking to an NPC or a monster or whatever.
Yeah.
Don't want to go to the dice. I do want to just inhabit that creature and understand their motivations and role play that entity. And then, you know, sometimes the players, they just say sensible things. And I find myself going, this is clearly not what the author of the content intended, but this is where we're going.
I will say, I have had some reaction roles recently. And I think it tends to be, I don't do it a lot. I tend to do it for a big critical thing. Again, whereby like, am I in my own, my head, am I, I'm distrusting myself. Am I giving away the whole game? Am I giving away the whole campaign by saying yes to this? So yeah. I'm generous with the bonuses. Frankly, my yes ands are, yeah, I'll give you a bonus for this. And yeah, I'll give you for a bonus for that. And like, we also have this secret. Sure. Yeah. Okay. I didn't see that. I'll give you a bonus for this. And there have been in the last couple of months, like maybe two or three big scale reaction roles, and about whether you were going to get an alliance with a particular people. And you know what? The players, I gave much, the players failed it. The players actually failed that important role. And I came back at them as, you're going to have to give them more. You're going to have, are you going to give them the secret to interstellar space travel? I think that's what you're going to have to. And that was a big, we are not happy with this violent, this group of violent people having interstellar space travel. And we're debating about what the monopoly trade counteroffer is going to be. And they were very, very unhappy and very uncomfortable with what they had to pay over.
Yeah.
So, I actually do, you know, I say yes to the bonuses, but I have had some reaction roles because I don't, you know, again, I'm secretly in favor of the players. I'm frankly rooting for them. And therefore I don't trust my own reaction in those major role play session moments. Mm-hmm. So I give it up to the dice.
Yep. That's reasonable. Dan, we're just about out of time here. Any final thoughts on the rule of cool?
You know, today, Paul, I'm going to have to process this one. I am so glad you told us about what to me is a very unusual role-playing session. I love the attitude that your players are bringing to stuff. I think the game system that you've picked with Quest is working magically well with that. Frankly, from what I get out of D&D myself is, and it's been very valuable in my life, is in a different part of the continuum where I want failure to be on the table no matter how cool it is. And sometimes our most heartfelt desires don't come to pass. And I frankly want to practice dealing with that. And for me, that's the biggest, that right there is the biggest thing that I get out of D&D. So I will want to continue running games that way. And I totally understand if people want something different from their gaming sessions. I totally get it. So we should be able to serve them too.
Yeah. Quest was a very happy accident for me. I think it is just the right level of scratching the crunchy itch a little bit for the players who want to dig into like figuring out what their ability progression is and trying to maximize their characters in that way. So they still get to do a little bit of that. But on the DM side, I just have this delightfully open door space to invent and still and a really good generic game dice mechanic that I can just lean on. Because I think like you, right, I agree. I do get uncomfortable with just yes and, you know, free flowing, just whatever we say happens kind of play. I still want a die roll in there, and I want modifiers. I'm gonna have to go back through the quest text and see if it talks about this anywhere. I don't think it does, but like, yeah, I want to be able to situationally modify the dice and push them towards success or towards failure, but still have the opposite on the table. Right? I want to veer away from just. It always happens or it never happens.
Maybe I don't mind, frankly, I don't mind the binary choice, but I think in Quest, maybe that tough choice zone has absorbed that DM measuring the differences. Maybe you could make the tougher choices tougher in those situations. Maybe that's the intent with Quest, possibly.
Mm. Mm. Maybe. Yeah. But again, I think it's been working pretty well for me to just say, like, yeah, it's still the die. You're still rolling the die. You just have -5 on it.
It sounds good.
Dragon's eye is very small. It's going to push you closer towards the failure end of the spectrum.
And our players are probably going to roll 20 anyway, so really it doesn't...
probably just rolling that 20, and then you're like, all right, well, fine. Fine. You do. You're amazing.
Always for me.
Viewers, if you have thoughts on the pros and cons of Rule of Cool, thoughts on stake setting, thoughts on the Quest RPG, please leave us comments here in the YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you. And maybe your ideas will percolate into a new topic for us in here, our 8th season of Wandering DMs.
Definitely. And as you're reaching for your D8, of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, GitHub. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites. So please look for us there and unleash that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are on our website at wanderingdms.com. Also available through various podcast carriers such as iTunes, Spotify, and Pocket Cast. If you're listening right now to the show on one of those sites and it gives the ability to do so, please take a minute to rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Every tier gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversation continues around 24/7 about role-playing games and modeling and horror games and miniatures and all kinds of stuff that we love, war games. And like Paul said at the top of the hour, we will be there in about 10 minutes to continue the conversation that we've had today in our live video after chat with our patrons. And frankly, I have some questions on my list here that I didn't get to fit into the hour. So we're going to continue this debate / conversation / inquiry when we get to our live video after chat in about 10 minutes there on Discord server. So we do hope that you'll be able to join us there. Don't forget that we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again as we continue season 8. Please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.